Try to click with what you got. Taste every potion. Cause if you like yourself a lot, go let it out. Go let it in. And go let it out.
Hey everyone, this is Ryan, and I'm joined today with a special guest. My buddy Patrick is here.
Yes, hello Ryan. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. So we don't have any of our usuals here, John or Wes, not present at all. So, you know.
And they will be missed. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Shame they passed away. You know, we're taking the reins. It's our show now. So.
I am a special guest for the Oasis album that we'll be discussing.
Right. Yeah. So that's, I think we realized this when we had a retro show. It was mostly centered around video games. And the early 2000s is kind of a dead time for Nintendo as a console. Like, the N64 was out, you know, they were making games occasionally, but there's so little content that we just decided it would be better to discuss the pop culture happenings, the current events.
I don't know. I played a lot of 007 Bond back in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So I felt like it still had some staying power.
It did, but there's only so much 007 you can talk about. Only so much GoldenEye can come up. It's the same with, like, all of the good games. Like, we haven't hit Ocarina of Time yet.
Ooh, one of my favorites.
Yeah, Majora's Mask is still to come.
Ooh.
Trying to think of what else. Like, of course, you know, Mario N64 mm-hmm. is a classic game.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, there's just not a lot of... Hard to find a new game every month to talk about.
True.
And also, there is the handhelds. But the handhelds, too, are kind of in this weird transition right now where the Game Boy Advance has yet to come out. And they're really not making a lot of content for Game Boy Color.
So, right.
Again, it's just kind of a tough time.
So we're going to dive into the oasis that is music during that time period.
Precisely, yes. In the desert of content, the oasis emerges, which is...
You like what I did there?
That's very nice. I like that. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. This could work out. So that's what we did. Like, we've been talking about music to kind of just bring up other stuff to talk about. By the way, I mean, did you want to talk about the 2000 primaries that happened that ended in March?
No, actually.
You don't want to get into politics?
Okay. No. We'll keep this above board.
All right, so anyway, yeah. So music, and I found that every month, 14 or 15 records worth discussing come out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I messaged you just because I wanted your opinion because this Oasis record, Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, came out. And I was like, what do you think about it? And you just showed me that you have this wealth of knowledge about this album, and I felt shitty just giving it like a 20-second hot take.
I don't know if wealth would be an understatement so much as an embarrassment of riches
yes.
of knowledge about this album. This is going to be probably one of the more embarrassing things I would say for other people to hear about me, but not for me myself. But I was a huge Oasis fan in the 90s when they came out. And so I was very much anticipating this album when it came out.
Yeah.
And...
Well, you and everybody else, man. Like, this was like Oasis kind of at the peak.
Yeah. So they had had their really big critical and commercial success in the mid-90s. And then
Definitely Maybe? No.
Definitely Maybe was their debut album.
What's the Story,
Morning Glory.
Right.
Be Here Now was an album that was, if you wanted to say, more anticipated than this one by miles, it was. And it lived up to hype, but then got detracted after that at the same time. So mm-hmm. it was a very bloated album. And then this one was sort of, was this going to be their tour de force, the coming back into what maybe Be Here Now should have been.
Yeah. And spoiler alert, 20 years down the road we're discussing this, so we have, you know, the future ahead of us to discuss, but they only released two more records, right? Two more full lengths get produced after this, and the last one came out in, I think, 2009, is that correct?
So they had three. They had Heathen Chemistry came out in a few years after this one, and then they had Don't Believe the Truth. So I want to say those would be like a 2004, 2006 range, and don't quote me on that one. And then you're right, the last one did come out in 2009, Dig Out Your Soul. And then they subsequently broke up on that tour for that album, which, you know, infamously, the Gallagher brothers were not known for being necessarily loving.
Yeah. You know, I think that the only people that they hate more than their fans are each other.
That's.
I think that they have this sibling, not even rivalry. It's like a sibling. Like they just seem like the two that just fight for no reason.
Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. There was a bootleg single that was released, and it was a recording of them fighting in the mid '90s. And it was called "Quibbling Rivalry," I believe. You can look that up. You can find that somewhere. I didn't buy it, but it's out there.
Yeah. Oh man. So again, sounds like you're a very big fan of this group. You like them a lot. You're a big fan of Britpop in general too, right?
Yeah, I think the thing was is that I grew up as a Beatles fan from a very early age from my dad's influence, and then you know, my coming of age was when grunge was starting to become very popular. I was in middle school and high school when that happened, and then although I liked it, I was looking for groups that sounded more like what I really loved, which was the Beatles, and all of a sudden I stumbled across Oasis, and you know, they're shamelessly, you know, saying they wanted to be just like the Beatles, and I said, well, I'm for that.
Yeah.
And then I dove into other bands after that. You know, The Verve is an example, or Verve as they're called in England.
Blur.
Yeah, Blur was a contemporary. They had a very big rivalry with them.
Oh, we'll get to it.
Oh, that's another podcast.
That's a lead.
But then you've got Travis open for them, and they became very popular. You've got you know, Manic Street Preachers. You've got Suede. I mean, I could probably name 20 other bands and still forget 20 that were just really popular during that time.
Okay. Well, I mean, my hot take on it, my quick opinion of the band is that they, to their benefit, they are some of the last true rock stars. They lived that rock star persona, that mm-hmm. lifestyle. They knew how to craft really catchy songs built for arenas. Yeah, they're obviously heavily influenced by the Beatles. I think they saw what made the Beatles tunes successful and emulated that very well. They're a karaoke band through and through. Like, you can't spend 2 hours in a karaoke bar and not hear an Oasis song.
Yeah, I think for the most part, I mean, I loved them. I knew what they were. They were, like you said, rock stars from the very beginning. They didn't shy away from that. I think that was a big contradiction from the American bands at the time, who were, for lack of a better term, angsty, like a Nirvana or a Pearl Jam. Oh, well, you know, we're making music, but we're not gonna be, you know, we're not gonna own up to this. We're angry at the world, or we're angry at our parents, or we're, you know, whatever the case may be. They were like, no, we're gonna do drugs, and we're gonna drink, you know, alcohol, and we're gonna smoke cigarettes, and we're gonna buy luxurious stuff, and we're going to be rock stars because that's what we want to be. I mean, in fact, the opening song on Definitely Maybe is Rock and Roll Star. So if you want to start, their first lead-in song on their debut album is about being a rock and roll star. So that's what they were. Yeah. And take them or leave them.
Yeah. I think that's actually a good way to put it, because it seems like you're right, that a lot of the grunge stars, it's like they couldn't admit they wanted the fame. And it's like, if you look at Oasis, they were upfront about it. Not only they were fixated on fame, obviously, but they felt like they deserved it.
Yeah,
they felt like they were deserved it, and at the same time, they were kind of above it too.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think you know, you've even got songs, and this is you know, you could go deep into their tracks. You've got songs that were written by Noel before they even became famous, "Going Nowhere." Like, that's a song about him basically living in Manchester, and he's writing songs, but he's not doing anything.
Yeah.
And so there's very much that longing to be famous, to be in the public eye.
Quick hit on it. That's kind of how the band came about, right? Liam was the one that had a group, and then Noel showed up and basically said, "You guys suck. I'm in the band. I write the songs."
Yeah. So he was a roadie for the Inspiral Carpets and had actually tried out to be a singer for that band, and they didn't take him, but he ended up helping them on their tours. And then,
but they made Liam should sing. Why? we'll hear Noel sing on this record.
Yeah.
He's got a great voice.
He does. So he comes back from this tour, and Liam's got this band, and he says, "Well, you know, I roadied for this band. I've written all these songs. If you guys want to be good, take my songs and let me do it." And they said, okay. And so then they started recording. And, you know, soon after that, it was Alan McGee saw him in Cat House in Glasgow and said, "You know, I'm going to sign you to Creation Records." And then, you know, that's where it took off. And you're right about, you know, the singing. I actually like Liam's voice better than Noel's, although Noel has a very good voice. I like Liam's like a cross between John Lennon and John Lydon, or Johnny Rotten from Sex Pistols. I think he's a good merger of both of those. And I think that's an affectation. I think he's trying to do that, yeah, which sounds great.
But it also it makes their songs unique.
Yeah.
And it makes them instantly stand out. You hear that voice, you know it's him. You know the band.
And then, you know, and you're right on that. And then Noel's voice, more softer tones, more subtle. Definitely fitting some of their more mid-tempo ballads for sure. Mm. And that was evident with Don't Look Back in Anger. But if you look early on, he had no... there was no shortage of aspirations for him to sing. Even on B-sides on their first album, he sang on those. So yeah, he always wanted to sing.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of wrote in my notes here that they have a habit of showing up late. They no-show. They show up drunk. They fight on stage. They cut their sets early. But like that's shitty. That's shitty rock star stuff to do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it kind of, in the same way that NoFX would name an album "I Heard They Suck Live," it almost creates this kind of theater. I don't know, this sort of I don't know, like, you want to go to their show just to see if this is the one where someone gets smashed over the head with a guitar.
Yeah.
Did you ever see them live?
I saw him live. I've seen him live a couple times.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing you'd want to have happen if your in-law showed up. Maybe they get smashed over the head by a guitar. but in all honesty, I will tell you this. For all of the reputation that they had for being a live performer that had those characteristics, their live performances are great. Like, if you want a band to sound the way they would sound on the record, they are one of the bands that did sound that way, okay? And I saw them first live in 1997 at UCF Arena in Orlando on the Be Here Now tour, and that was the loudest concert I think still I've ever been to. Yeah, my ears were ringing. And that's one of the things that people don't get, I think, about Oasis. You know, there's going to be the guy that's in your bar down the street that's going to play Wonderwall as an acoustic guitar thing, or Don't Look Back in Anger, or some of the other ones, and you're like, yeah, Oasis, you know, that's what they do. A lot of their songs were really hard rocking songs that were loud. I mean, they had a whole wall of sounds thing that we'll get into later. But I think for the most part, you know, their live performances, besides the bickering, or if you know, the brothers are arguing with each other in between songs, during the actual songs, they were pretty good. From what I've seen. And of course, you know, you'll have your performances here and there where, like you said, they got cut short, or you know they weren't playing necessarily to their highest ability. But overall, from my experience, even with having bootlegged albums of live performances, they have a recent one that came out that's great, that was from the peak of their time period in 1995-96, and it was recorded in Cardiff. I think it's called JIYL. It's a bootleg. But overall, for the most part, I mean, any of their live performances were pretty good. Sounded most like the records, especially the big ones when they knew they were rock stars.
There's some artists that just have that reputation. Again, Andrew WK is one of those artists that is like he is living that rock star lifestyle.
Yeah,
and like his live shows are absolutely bonkers. They are fucking crazy.
Now, they did have a live album that came out. It was Familiar to Millions, and that one came out almost around the same time as this album. And that one was not one of their better performances, but it was, they were cashing in on their success at the time.
Yeah.
And I know Liam, for a period of time, had some degradation to his voice due to the excessive, you know, party style, Andrew WK party, you know.
Party hard. Yeah. That'll fuck you up.
You know, he really did he took a toll, I guess, on his voice, but... Like I said before, you know, if you go back and you look at some of these things that were recorded and released, you'll find that I think that their live performances were, in fact, pretty good.
Yeah. All right. So I guess, you go into this as much as you want. This doesn't have to be autobiographical for you, but February of 2000, what was that? What were you up to then?
I was in college drinking.
Yeah.
No.
Where'd you go to school?
I went University of Florida.
Oh, that's what that shirt's about. I saw Gators across.
No, this is actually a Gatorland shirt. Thanks for noticing. No,
that place is amazing.
It is. No, was at University of Florida. I was a sophomore in college then. And by then I had started really picking up, playing guitar and doing my own thing. And my favorite band from high school was coming out with a new record, and I was excited. I remember that there was a lead single that came out ahead of time, which was something that it happens now on Spotify, but for a while it didn't happen, you know, during that period. But you'd have a song played on the radio, or a song, you know, you could go pick it up at your local CD shop and
pick a 3-track single.
Yeah. And so that was Go Let It Out. And I was really excited about the album when I first heard that single. I thought the lyrics were good. A little bit more expansive than their other lyrics, which had not had the best reputation. And there was
a bit true.
Yeah. And the other lead up was they had gone through a lineup change. So they had lost
the drummer. Right.
They had kept the drummer. Oh. They had kept the two brothers. They lost the original bassist and the original guitarist. Giggsy is the name of the bassist. And then Bonehead was the name. These are nicknames. I don't think those are their birth names. But Bonehead was the guitarist. So that was something that we had all thought about during the time period.
Traditional English name. Bonehead upon Avon.
Bonehead upon Avon, I think, yeah. Or I think it was Bonehead upon, Stratford, something. But it was something that we had all anticipated going into the record as fans, I guess. You would say, okay, well, they're going to have to sound different.
Yeah.
And that was what we thought, and then the first single did.
Yeah, okay. So in the year 2000, you know, like, I guess I was actually a sophomore in high school at the time.
Oh, wait, great.
So did you have a lot of friends that you, like, clicked with musically on that? Did you have other, like, friends in college that were maybe Britpop fans, or probably people just knew who Oasis was and were like, yeah, sure, man, they make those fucking tunes?
So I had one of my best friends in college who was my roommate that my junior year. So this would have been my second year. We became roommates my junior year. He had not listened to him as much until I met him, and then he got really into them really fast. So we were both highly anticipating this. And then I have two cousins that live in the Chicago area that were big Oasis fans as well. So, you know, whether you're on Instant Message AIM, which was big at the time, you know, you'd be saying, okay, well, it's coming out. That's Did you listen to the single? Do you know what you think?
What was your handle back then?
Mine
was Brack Owns Me. Brack from the TV show.
Mine was Pat Wreck. Pat Wreck. PATWRECK, because that was a punny name, and I'm still punny to this day.
It's a shame we don't let kids name themselves, you know? Like, we'd have some pretty awesome handles.
Yeah, Handle Face.
Yeah, right.
I think it would come up once in a while.
All right, so I'm going to hit you with some Oasis fun facts. Tell me if you've heard what I'm about to tell you, because there's a lot of shit to discuss here.
Okay.
So, first one, they were sued by Coca-Cola for their song Shaker Maker, which is blatantly rips it off.
Yeah. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Yeah.
A perfect harmony. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But here's the thing. I got, in their defense, it sounds satirical. I think that they're intentionally poking fun at crass commercialism of jingles to sell shitty Coke. A shitty soda.
It's funny because Shaker Maker references a soda shop or a shop that they used to go to in Manchester. It was Mr. Sifter Soda Sells when I was just 16. So they're talking about commercialism in that. And I don't have the lyric right on that because I didn't look it up. But yeah, you could definitely say that. You could definitely also say that Noel Gallagher, when in a pinch, would pinch something, and he wasn't ashamed of it.
Yeah, I saw some other songs, and they did vaguely resemble other songs. I think that they were accused of ripping off a T-Rex tune, Mega Gong, classic rock song. Again, in the same way that this band is inspired by the Beatles, I'm not gonna blame them for realizing what is successful in music and aspiring to make something like it.
Right. The T-Rex song is Cigarettes and Alcohol. That would be along the lines of the Vanilla Ice and Queen David Bowie reference. I mean, it is pretty much, there's like one note that's different. Otherwise, it's almost the same.
Yeah. But yeah, Coca-Cola took about 600 grand in GBPs off of them. Right? To which that they returned at the end of it. They said, after having paid that fine, they were asked about it, and one of the two brothers said, we're now Pepsi drinkers. So again,
classic. Yeah. They're very witty. recently I've been I revisited some Led Zeppelin stuff. And Led Zeppelin got in some trouble with doing that with some blues artists, some of the early blues artists.
Everything comes from something.
Yeah. And you know, if you're gonna say, well, that's what we're gonna judge them on, you know, you've got a lot more music artists you're gonna have to judge. So
I mean, there's so many vocal pop groups from the 50s and 60s that were black artists that their song became successful when a handful of white dudes sung it.
Right. And if you think about it, you know, maybe he lifted a melody for the lyric, but, you know, you've got everything else going on. You've got the bass, you've got the guitar, you've got the drums, you've got a lot of other stuff that's out there. If Coke wants to sue him, then Coke can sue him, but still a great song. And at the end of the day, it's catchy, and hey, that was a catchy jingle anyway, so.
And for them, I'm sure that is enough. Cause this is a band that's selling 22 million copies of records. Like, they can fuck off for 600 grand. It's not that big of a hit to them.
Can't wait for the day for me for that to happen.
Yeah, right? You know, and it's a funny controversy for them. Isn't it funny that they get themselves wrapped up in this kind of shit? Because this happens all the time. Next, George Harrison said they are rubbish, to which Liam replied that he is a nipple.
Wow.
Nipple is a British slang for a dullard and idiot.
Yeah, I think I remembered them getting into something with George Harrison.
George Harrison shit-talked a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, he's weird because, as the quiet Beatle, he's got a lot of opinions. I think for the most part, I'm not sure where he came from that. I don't know if he listened much to what they were doing or just wanted to, if he just wanted to offer an opinion. Overall, the only connection I knew other than this, because I did hear that he had talked some crap about him, was that of course, Wonderwall is named after his project Wonderwall Music that came out in the 60s.
Right. It was like a soundtrack?
I think it was an instrumental soundtrack.
And it was the very first post-Beatles, the Beatles thing. Like, the first member of a Beatles.
I think he was the first one that did a solo thing. But I still think they were together. I think it was released in 68.
Okay.
But, yeah. For all of the beef they may have had with him, I think Noel had a good relationship with Paul McCartney. I haven't heard anything with Ringo Starr, and of course, you know, they're big admirers of the Beatles.
Yes.
But if he shit talked them and he shit talked to other people, then, you know, then I believe there's something deeper than just maybe a superficial not love for Oasis, for lack of a better term.
Well, one more Beatle thing related. Noel Gallagher said on songwriting, this is a direct quote from the man, with every song that I write, I compare it to the Beatles. The thing is, they only got there before me. If I had been born at the same time as John Lennon, I'd have been up there.
That's kind of a good take, because I've thought about that a lot. Because whenever I listened to the Beatles records when I was younger, of course I loved them, they sound great. But then as I learned how to play guitar and started recording music for myself, I'm like, well, these are the bass chords, you know, they're writing the songs. Maybe they were the first to just get out there and do this and try putting X chords together, and now we're coming along and they've already got the map and we're supposed to deviate from that map. And I don't think he's too far off in that statement in terms of knowing where the Beatles were at the time that they were doing it. There had to be a first.
Yeah.
They happened to be the first. So, yeah, if he wanted to transplant himself then and say, well, I've got this knowledge, I think I could do this, maybe he could have. But
A better point would be to say, if the roles were reversed, would John Lennon have sold 22 million copies of a record in 1999 or 1994? You know?
Well, yeah, you got to think about that. That's definitely
there is a point to be made there, but that is going to get a finger pointed at you, Noel Gallagher, and saying, you asshole.
And he's, there's probably countless fingers already pointed at him for that very reason. But I would say this. I would say I'd take some of John Lennon. I would take a lot of John Lennon's lyrics over Noel's any of the day. So he still has a lot of catching up to do, even if he was ahead of him. But they're still great.
All right. Next thing I got for you. This is apparently true. I looked this up. I figured this had to be some kind of joke that they were saying. This is apparently legit. Liam's inspiration for becoming a singer came from hearing Madonna's Like a Virgin after he had been was in the hospital from getting hit in the head with a hammer at school.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
So he said he got jumped by the way, of course he would. He's such an asshole. He got jumped by classmates and got hit in the head with a hammer so hard that they cracked his skull, put him in the hospital, and he said he woke up listening to Madonna and I guess thought to himself, if she can do this, so can I. Which, one, that's about, like, Madonna's probably, like, the worst vocalist in pop music. She's truly bad. Madonna is...
Oh, wait a minute.
Not a good singer.
Like a Prayer is a pretty good song.
Her tunes are good, and she knows how to capitalize on controversy.
Mm-hmm.
She is a shit singer. Fun fact, we're not talking about fucking Madonna. Did you know that when she did Evita, they hired a vocal coach to teach her how to sing?
I think Madonna's been compared, pretty accurately to Britney Spears in terms of the singing. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would certainly not say Britney Spears is a great singer either. But Britney Spears, again, also kind of capitalized on the image. I haven't seen her dance routines lately. She was a great dancer. She had all of that going for her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, compared to someone like Christina Aguilera, who is a similar of hers, and like Christina Aguilera's voice is incredible
mm-hmm.
by comparison.
So I think
Madonna is a shit singer.
Okay,
surrounded by incredible voices in her era.
All Madonna fans, he is at Ryan Rogers. You can find him. yeah. But in all Britney Spears fans, I'm at Patrick James. But in all actuality, what I would say is this. I'm not going to say that I think that they're shit singers or I don't think that they're very good. If his take on it was when he woke up that he thought he could do it just as well or better, then I don't say that that's his attitude. So I would believe that 100%. Yeah. I did hear that his inspiration to become a singer was listening to Madonna. So I had heard that. I hadn't heard that second part.
Well, those are the circumstances.
Yeah. By which but I had heard that it was something along the lines of he had heard Madonna sing something and thought, well, I could do it. Wow. And I had heard that.
Jeez. All right. Here's a quote. This is a quote from Noel about Liam. I love this. This is like one of the best quotes.
I already believe it.
This quote is better than any lyric he's ever written.
I believe that too.
And describing Liam, he's rude, arrogant, intimidating, and lazy. He's the angriest man you'll ever meet. He's like a man with a fork in a world of soup.
I believe it 100%.
And what a dig.
I know.
Saves the best insults for his brother.
I know. So I think the thing is that it's like I wouldn't describe Liam if you've ever seen him in an interview or anything like that. He's like a kid that can't see but doesn't have glasses. But wants you to think that he can see anyway, and he's going to tell you that he can see, and he's going to show you.
He's going to bullshit.
Yeah, and then he's going to make you believe it, even though you know that he can't see. And so that's the way. If I were to describe it, then that's a personal experience because I have glasses. That's the way I would think he is. He is that much of a.
So he's just sitting there with a smug, kind of
stubborn person. Cross-eyed. Yeah, right. And he's going to tell you, yeah, I can see exactly what you're doing. Wow. He heckled his own brother. He opted out of the MTV Unplugged performance.
This
the
is,
day
this
of.
Is, by the way, my very last thing that I was going to bring up on my list here was yeah.
Okay, so we'll get into
go ahead,
this.
No, go ahead.
So he opts out of the MTV Unplugged performance.
Yeah.
Complaining that he was sick and had a sore throat, then proceeded to sit in the balcony and drink a bunch of beers and smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
And then heckling his own brother, who's singing the songs that he was supposed to be singing, and telling him how bad he was. And actually, that performance was really, really good. There's bootlegs out there of it. I don't think they've released it officially.
I saw a video on YouTube of this, and it was apparently, and I guess this is common for the MTV Unplugged format, where they'll have them re-record a song.
Mm-hmm.
So for the audience, and of course the audience is pumped about it, they get to hear another song that they love from this band. So
mm-hmm.
on the one that they're closing out, that's when he really lays into him, and you can see him up there, like beer and cigarette in hand, mm-hmm. just like that fucking Leo meme.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. He's yeah. It's like Noel's the cat at the table, and Liam is both of the women yelling at the cat at the table
precisely,
at the same time. He's two of them. No, you know, that's, you know, love it or leave it.
All right, and two more quick hits, if you're ready for them. Two more quick facts.
Sure.
Liam has taken to calling Noel a potato.
That's correct.
Over Twitter.
Yes.
In 2016. three images of him posting simply a picture of his brother with all caps potato above it.
I think that happened probably a couple weeks ago too.
Really?
So yeah,
they're back at it.
No, he's always at it. So it oscillates between there's a old I'm gonna date myself. There's a Dr. Katz sketch where John Stewart is on there, and
nice.
and he was a psychiatrist for comedians, and so there's
show is fantastic.
Yeah,
early John Benjamin show.
Right, right. H. John Benjamin. Mm-hmm. Don't forget the H.
Okay.
And then he's basically asking them questions, and they're doing their bits, and so he has this point where John Stewart, I think it's John Stewart, it could be a different comedian, so, you know, nerds out there, let me know. But he's saying this point where he's saying, well, I like to pat people on the back when I'm hugging them, because he's like, I'm hugging them, but I'm hitting you. That is the way I would describe their relationship. Yeah, that's the way I would describe the Gallagher brothers' relationship. Is like, on the one hand, they've been broken up now since 2009, and Liam desperately wants to reconvene them in some way, shape, or form, and do a concert or record again or whatever, maybe recapture what they had. But on the other hand, he's going to sit there and call his brother potato, or tell him he's the biggest, you know, cunt on the face of the planet.
Yeah.
Pardon my French or English. And that's just the way that it's going to work out. And so,
well, they seem like the kind of brothers that just roughhouse. They're like a lot of families would probably be like, you just put a hand on your brother, how dare you? But that just seems like this is their style, and they behave that way with everybody. Like, they'll throw down, they're not breaking necks.
Yeah, well, replace the hand with a lead pipe, and I think you've got them.
Yeah. Oh, well, that wasn't even one of my facts, but apparently in 1994, and then again in 2008, I think it was, mm-hmm. Noel was beaten down on stage by random fans. Like, twice. And I was like, that's impressive, a 14-year gap between getting your shit kicked in on stage during one of your performances.
No, I hadn't heard that. So we'll have to Snopes that one. But yeah. I think, for the most part, you know, if that did happen, I mean, if you're going to be an asshole, sometimes someone's going to
be an asshole. Oh, and I'm not saying they did anything to deserve it. Like, you know, there could have been any myriad circumstances that brought about those events. Just saying.
Final thing on them, the second gig I saw was a much smaller gig at the Hard Rock in Orlando. So you go from the UCF Arena at the time, probably about like a 8,000, 9,000 venue.
Yeah.
I went to
UCF, so yeah. I went to a number of shows there.
And then what would you say the capacity would be there?
It's a pretty rough estimate, but I'd say that's about right. 8,000, 9,000 sounds good.
And so then that Hard Rock in Universal, I think, is probably a 3,000 max.
Yeah, that's
standing room only.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second time I saw them.
Yeah.
And they seemed bigger than life at that show, even more so than the loudest show that I've been to. They almost seemed like they didn't belong on that stage. They should have been, well, they're an arena band, you know, in England, I guess. And they seemed that way at that show. And both shows were great. They were both great live.
Yeah.
We had talked about when the first time I saw it, and I wanted to bring that up because I'd forgotten about that second time, which was pretty cool. It was nice to see him intimate.
In a smaller venue, yeah.
And he didn't get beat up at that show, so that was good.
That's good. I think the beatings are not that frequent for them, but it seems to happen. You know, every once in a while a snare has to get kicked over, mm-hmm. or someone has to get a pick thrown at him, or a drumstick or something. Mm-hmm. All right, so, yeah.
Okay, and now we have the microphone plugged in correctly. Isn't this... Yeah.
This is... I hope it's much better.
This is going to sound a lot smoother.
I think so. Yeah. Let's hope so.
Our dulcet sounds will come through a little
bit. I know, yeah. Those wavering inflections in my voice will be a little bit more clearer now.
You are so melodious.
Oh, yeah. I'm Melodious Thunk. Yes. Is my name.
All right, so where we were actually about to pick up is just going to do a track-by-track breakdown. This album's only got, 10, really 9.5 songs. If you want to just dig into them, I don't think it's going to take too long for us to get through the full length. And if you've got some extra observations maybe about some B-sides that might be better than the album itself, then we'll get to that, huh?
Yeah, it sounds good. Yeah, you're right. 10 tracks, which, again, if you go back to 2000 me, you're thinking, okay, well, we've got, there was a Be Here Now, I think, was clocked in at 70-plus minutes. I think 76 minutes or something like that.
Shit.
I know. It was a long, long album. And so then you're coming back and go, okay, we're going to have 10 tracks. One of them is going to be an instrumental. We'll get to that one. And then you've got three that were sung by Noel. So you've got 6 Liam songs, 3 Noel songs, and an instrumental. And you're thinking, okay, well, let's see how that goes.
It clocks in about, if I remember correctly, 37 minutes. So not the longest album in the world. Mm-hmm. But maybe once or twice, in my personal opinion, we'll feel the runtime.
You will feel the runtime on a couple songs, and then you'll wish a couple songs were longer, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a point of comparison at the time... just 2 months after this, because I know so much about the music that came out in the year 2000. The Hives would release Vinny Vidi Vicious.
Oh, one of my favorites. Yeah.
That's 12 tracks in 27 minutes. Man, they pound that one out.
Yeah. They put you on, you're in the fast lane on the highway, and then they just eject you right out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That one's a great one. Okay.
All right, so let's first track, the one that you were talking about, the instrumental, is Fuckin' in the Bushes.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, your take at the time was it's an absolute banger, great guitar riff, drum and bass sound full, deep and amazing, interesting use of British TV show clips, an homage to the Beatles doing I Am the Walrus, which, if I've got that right, is part of a compilation record they released a couple years before it. Is that not right? I believe in 1998, I saw that they released,
Oasis did?
B-sides? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And there was I'm certain there was a Beatles cover on there, and I think it might have been that.
Right. So, I think there's two things here. So, let's go for the instrumentation first. Yeah. That was kind of the change in sound that I thought was going to happen. So, you've got, big, bright drums, whereas before the drums a lot of times were buried in the mix on their first three albums. This was just the first thing you had was just drums right in your face on this one. Really good guitar riff, one of the better riffs that I think that he's written in his entire career. Overall, just it's a good palate cleanser. And they did this once before with the Swamp Song. They would open gigs with an instrumental song, and the Swamp Song was a good one that they did. That was the untitled track on What's the Story, Morning Glory. There were two of them that had excerpts of that song, and then it was released as a B-side.
Oh, okay.
But this one I really liked in terms of it's just really rocking, for lack of a better term. But the other thing that I would say about my comment would be at the end of I Am the Walrus, there are excerpts of, I think it's King Lear, or it's something. It was a British television broadcast, and it was played over the outro for I Am the Walrus. And in this song, they use excerpts of spoken word as well. And I thought at the time, and I think that it's not, well, the way I would put it is that I think that it's something that they would have been conscious of, that I think that it's an homage to that. And that's where I put that reference. But to your point about I'm the Walrus, they released that as a B-side to Cigarettes and Alcohol. It was a live performance of I'm the Walrus, and they were notorious for dragging out that outro and Noel doing all these kind of weird sonic things on his guitar for that outro. Just crazy notes and everything like that. Amazing the way that they would perform that, and it was a great cover. But yeah, that's kind of my take on that overall song. I just think it's a great album opener.
I looked it up. Yeah, it's on something called The Master Plan. I don't know if that...
Yep, that was a compilation of B-sides that was released because basically the quality of their B-sides for the first three albums was equivalent to actually being able to put out an album.
Yeah, Noel said that in the production of this Standing on the Shoulder of Giants that he was expecting 20 songs. Not that he was going to release 20 songs, but he wanted to record 20 songs.
I think they ended up doing that. So, with the 10 on the album, and they had two or three B-sides for each single, they got close to that, I thought.
Yeah, from what I saw on their list, this album saw three different singles get made.
Yep.
So, yeah. So that's kind of how they started. It's just that instrumental. And again, like you're saying, the drums are really full and lush and in your face. It reminds me a bit of an Amen Break, just a little bit. Just because that it has such a nice pop to it. It just sounds so good.
So different than their last album.
Yeah. Next track is the big single from this album, Go Let It Out.
Yeah.
And you said, first single here, absolutely loved it. Great melody, great instrumentation. Bass line is superb. Vocals hit. Guitars are just right, but a little less from their previous albums. Yes, the first singer, banger as well.
Yeah, I thought this... When I first heard it, I was immediately struck with it. I thought it was a great song. There is use of a Mellotron, I think, or some sort of keyboard aspect. It sounds like a Mellotron, but it's just very like a kind of thing. But overall, that was one of the things when I was anticipating the changes in the lineup, I was like, well, who's going to play bass? Noel plays bass. And so one of the first things that you get in this song whenever the bass kicks in, which actually Liam says, or it could be Noel in the background, I think, if you listen to it closely enough, it goes, pick up the bass, and then it goes, boom, ba-na-na-na-na-na. And you've got that more melodic bass. That sounds like a Paul McCartney bass, to be honest, which, again, you know, no surprise there. But overall, just a very strong single, good lead guitar parts. Again, less lead guitar than was the last album, which was overdubbed to death with lead guitar. So that was something to be expected. You thought if they're going to change their direction and sound, that's what they're going to do. And it's solid. I mean, it clocks in probably, what, like 3.5 minutes, maybe 3 minutes and 50 seconds. And it's everything you want from a single. Yeah. Strong verse, strong chorus, strong hook. Done.
Well, actually, I mean, that's one of the things I'll say about a number of the tracks on this record is that the guitar tones are great. The guitars really do sound good on this whole record.
Yeah.
And this is one where they really do sound fantastic. They shine.
Yeah.
All right. Next track you get is Who Feels Love? And you wrote...
Question mark.
Oh, yeah.
Who feels love? I do.
I don't know. Does my voice go up enough at the end?
Is there a question mark at the end? I think, right?
In your notes, you did not put a question mark.
It may not be.
In mine, I did. Oh, I did put a question mark in mine, therefore, fact. 100% fact.
Okay, yes, I thought
there
so.
There is a question mark.
Yeah.
And I kind of hit the same thing that you did here, what you're saying. Obvious Beatles 60 rock homage. As backwards guitars, tablas, second single, thought there were stronger tracks on the record.
Still think that. Overall, it is that. It opens up with backwards guitars and backwards cymbals. And I was just like, you know, we've seen this in the mid-60s. We know what this is. But we know what they like. And we know what they want to record. So I don't think that it's... The instrumentation on it is very, very good. I think the songwriting is somewhat lackadaisical. If you wanted to ask me personally.
What do you think they meant by thank you for the song?
Which one? you know, are they talking about our sun, the Helios, as it were?
Lyrics.
Or are they talking about their own children? Who knows? It's just too vague and too trite, to be fair.
Yeah, I think a lot of their lyrics, especially on this record, do come through so hollow.
Yeah.
There's very few actual words said. They repeat phrases over and over again. It's just... not really indicative of great songwriting. It's almost like they got these little blurb punchlines or like these little witticisms they want to give you.
One of the things that's interesting about Noel Gallagher's interviews and what he talks about songwriting is that I think he is okay with throwaway lyrics. One particular interview that I'm thinking of was when he was writing Supersonic, which is a great, that was our first single, and it's a great single, great song. But he was like, I'm feeling supersonic, give me gin and tonic. And he says, that rhymed, and I liked that. And I was like, well, there's not much thought in that, based on what you're telling me. And so, you know, to go back to what I was saying earlier, you know, I take probably John Lennon's lyrics over Noel Gallagher's lyrics any day of the week.
Yes.
And so then if you're going to transpose them, then we have a lot still left to be desired. This song is one of them.
Yeah. Very, very bland lyrics.
But meticulous recording. Instrumentation is fantastic.
Yeah, the tune itself sounds great and is well recorded, as is this whole record.
Yeah.
But, man, you know, you kind of just wish that they would expand on thoughts. Just, like, have a couple more sentences about what you just said even means, if it means anything to you. Or, again, like you're saying, maybe he just liked the way it sounds, so that's the thing that he said.
Sometimes you got to have a thought to back it up.
Yeah, and even on the band's biggest hits, their biggest jams, I mean, it's still the lyrics sometimes make little to no sense.
Yeah.
They're just kind of there because there have to be words.
And I think, to be fair, you know, if you're going to talk about lyrics and whether or not they make sense, you know, you've got somebody, if you listen to some Nirvana lyrics, you go back and go, okay, well, some songs, they kind of sound like a hodgepodge. And you're like, okay, well, what is he saying there? Oh, well, he's a tortured soul, so we've got to interpret it more. And then you've got someone like Noel Gallagher saying, well, I thought it rhymed nice. And what if he had not said that? Would we be interpreting it more, right?
Sure.
To play devil's advocate, do I think that necessarily? No. But
that's sort of like saying, what about Gavin Rossdale? Gavin Rossdale's an incredible songwriter, and he's in the grunge scene. It's sort of like...
But Bush's lyrics make no sense to me whatsoever either.
Yeah, or like, what about Elliott Smith? I've been listening to a lot of that.
Yeah,
Figure Eight, because it came out around the same time, mm-hmm. and I'm blown away by how well it's written.
Right. And so you got to say, okay, is the upfront too upfront for Noel Gallagher to the point where he's saying, well, I just thought it rhymed well. But if he had not said that, would we be taking his lyrics more seriously?
When you've got the hits, when you've got the anthems to back it, like Queen. Queen has shallow lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
Queen, like all their big jams are literally designed to just make a stadium of people do something in unison, like a kindergarten teacher would do with their children.
Yeah.
Like that is very, some would argue insulting to the audience that they do.
Right.
You know, but in the same way, like when this album doesn't have those big hits, the lyrics really do stick out.
Yeah.
It's not, just not being there.
This was, even when I first listened to it back in 2000, I was like, okay, there's some cringe-worthy stuff here.
Oh, yeah. I did not expect you to come in here being like, no, these guys are fucking incredible writers. They've said they're not great writers.
And this one was the first one. I thought Go Let It Out was good.
Do you think Noel ever sometimes writes lyrics just to make Liam say them aloud? Like, do you think that he would be spiteful in that regard?
That he would
make his brother
sing
lyrics that are self-referential?
No, because he's the songwriter. So I would completely 100% say no, because he's taking credit for it.
Yeah.
We'll get to the point where I think that's not true, too.
Mm,
okay. Track 5. We'll get to track 5.
Okay, all right. Well, then let's move on to the next one. So that was Who Feels Love. Now we got Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is. This one kind of felt like a single to me.
It's got a great riff.
Yeah, it's a, like you said, cool riff, sound, although a little basic. Lyrics leave a lot to be desired. Album filler track, but you liked it.
Yeah, so it has single potential written all over it if it popped more with the lyrics. It's got a nice, like I said again, they were changing their sound, so they've got like this kind of like keyboard, like bass track, and he is wailing on guitar over it, and the drums are there, and again, everything is basic down. We don't have this wall of sound that we had before.
The thing I love is that big vocal rave up at the end that occurs.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone's just like, wah, at the end.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really well done. And then you're just like, we're going to repeat the same verse, and we're going to repeat the same chorus, but it's not really lyrically profound. So again, you're kind of left wondering, well, it sounds really good.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at. Mm. And overall, I again, like, the production is great. The instrumentation is great. He's playing the bass. He's playing the drums. He's probably playing the keyboard to a certain degree. They did have a keyboardist that came in on this album. Drummer's doing great. Liam's vocals, the way they filtered it through, I'm like, he's sounding as sneering as best as ever. Everything is great. And then we're just missing that je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, how do you say?
How do you say that? Yeah. you just don't know what it could have been with just a little bit extra.
Yeah. All right, next track.
Little James. Track on the album. Yeah. Worst track on the album.
Liam's first song he wrote, very simple. Helped a lot with production. Lyrics are bad. Melody simple. Would have left it off.
I would have left it off. Yeah, you're right. And we'll get to how I would have left it off later. But this is what I would say. I think this is a bone thrown to him at the crux of having the whole band dynamic shift and change. I think this was, for lack of brotherly love that we talked about earlier, this is a brotherly love thing that happened.
Yeah.
And I think he said, you got a song? Yeah, we'll put it on there. Oh, you're going to do G and D and C and that's it? And that's going to do the whole thing? Then that's going to be fine. And you're going to say, my child, who was a child, swam in the ocean like a child? Okay, we'll keep that lyric in. Which is the worst simile I've ever heard in my entire life. So if you're thinking about things that could be even worse than what they've already put on the album, then this is worse.
Yeah.
And I'd hate to critique somebody like that as a personal songwriter, because I'm not saying that I'm even better or worse. But what I would say is that if you're going to throw that out there and say, okay, well, this is what I'm going to put on an album and be like, I'm a rock star, well, not that great.
Yeah.
In my personal opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it is a low point on the album. And it's just kind of, this is already an album that's having a hard time feeling fun. You know, you're really having a hard time, like, getting into it the same way that you would have gotten under the previous records. So this is just kind of a dull moment. The organ is fine. Like, it's cool that there's that organ playing throughout.
They're helped by the production. I think that the sound and the sonicness of everything is great. I mean, if you'd said, I'm going to make an album and I'm going to do the Shins record, but I'm going to use this producer and this production, you may have some completely different. The Shins may be the biggest band in the world at this point. You know what I mean?
True.
That's kind of where I'm looking at it with this. It's funny that you mentioned it about it being not the biggest. It's taking a tone towards not being an upper as opposed to a downer. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. It just feels like this is, you know, as there's crescendos on an album when looking at multiple songs together, this one feels like it's sort of coming down. It's sort of bringing you down before it brings you back up.
So an interesting thing about this album was that they both kicked hard drugs for this album. And we didn't talk about this earlier.
Oh, that's what it was. They even called, what was the one before this? Be Here Now? They called that their cocaine album?
Yes, they did.
Because they were apparently just riding the rails the whole time.
A lot of treble and a lot of guitar overdubs.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was the coming down album. Even though it was supposed to be a supposed reset, return to form possibly, they had said that it was a coming down album. This song came down too far.
Yeah, I mean, and that doesn't necessarily what it means when you go clean that's what happens. Like, you can go clean and be completely reinvigorated.
Yeah, I think Aerosmith did it. But
not a good band to bring up.
What?
It's not a good band.
Oh, no.
Again, it's...
that's what they said.
Aerosmith is like kind of like the laziest, lowest effort commercial rock band.
Oh, yeah. No, totally agree. But that's what they were saying they were doing. So,
yeah.
However you wanted to do it. But what I'm saying is that in their terms, in Oasis's terms, this was their coming down album, getting clean, re-cleaning everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, like doing what they felt they needed to do to get their house in order.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Oh, and again, to bring it back up, the next track is one of the biggest ragers on it, Gas Panic.
Great song.
Exclamation point at the end, Gas Panic.
Yeah, we're in full on panic mode.
To which you said, amazing, excellent production, instrumentation, and overall song. Could be the best song they ever put out.
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. What were your initial reactions on that one when you heard it?
Hate to say this. I loved listening through it till about the 4 minute mark, and I was like, that's a good song. And then I realized there's going to be 2 more minutes. There's 2.5 more minutes of this shit. Like, they had this giant fucking guitar solo that ripped, and then it just seemed like the song was about to end, and then it just kind of kept meandering for a while. I think it's 4 minutes of the best, probably four of the best minutes on the entire record, but again, it just kind of overstays as well. At the end.
It does have a very long outro, and I'm glad that I asked you first before I talked about it, because I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
And I still think it's one of the best songs they've ever put out.
Yeah.
Because it's great production. It's new stuff they had never done before. It's emotive in the right way. It's literally about Noel Gallagher kicking drugs. And he's having these panic attacks in the middle of the night. And then the way the song crescendos into that apex that you're talking about with the guitar solo,
yeah,
it just goes into a different direction. And there's probably musical theory to back me up that I don't have on hand, but they were doing like a vocal chorus, whatever, and then they just go into this other land where they did the rest of the song, and then it should have ended. Then it kind of just mellowed out and petered out a little bit. I feel like that's maybe what he thought should have happened, but I think you're right. I think it could have just ended, maybe even ended like from Abbey Road, She's So Heavy, or I Want You, She's So Heavy is the name of the song, and they just stopped that song right in the middle of it.
Yeah,
it's almost like they could have just stopped that song, and then it would have been just perfect. But
then still played Her Majesty. The 13 seconds.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, we need that. We need that. And you never give me your money either. All those other songs.
Okay, all right. Next song we've got is Where Did It All Go Wrong? And you said, why is Noel singing this? Best written song on the album, but probably the most personal, so Noel sings it. I believe it would be a single if Liam sung it. So it sounds like your big issue is about who's singing the track.
I think so. So I said this earlier, and I'm not going to back down from it. I think that in the Britpop scene, in the Brit rock scene, in the indie scene, because that's what they called it there, even though it's pretty much pop music, the way that scene was evolving, his voice and he was an icon, and he should have been singing most of the songs. Even though Noel's voice is very good, we've already talked about this with the Unplugged and all the other stuff that he sang. So if you're going to have a strong song on an album and you want your album to be as successful as possible, give it to the strongest singer. And I think that's where you have the dynamic between the two brothers really comes to a head. And I think that's where the egos come to a head. If you're not going to let him sing the best song on the album, then if that's the one you're going to sing, then don't sing any of the other ones. You know what I mean? So, or give him better songs to sing if you're going to be the songwriter.
Yeah.
That's where I thought the problem was, and that's where I thought the egos were, and that's where I went back to what we were talking about with whenever they initially took over, and whenever he initially got into the group and he took over songwriting responsibility, it's like, okay, we get it. You're going to be the songwriter, but it's like the Kinks. You know, are you going to be the Ray Davies? Are you going to be the Day Davies? Are you going to be the guy who's going to be the singer? Are you going to be the guy who's going to be the songwriter? And you got to pick one or the other, but this song was good.
Yeah.
It was great. Never released it as a single, and it's probably the best song on the album. Even though Gas Panic, I think, is the best thing they ever recorded, I still think this one's the best song on the album.
Yeah.
Which is hard to... It's a weird take to have.
Yeah, I get that.
And it's most heartfelt.
Yeah. I think I already told you earlier, this is by far my favorite song of these 10 tracks that they have here, this is easily the best song.
Lyrics are the best
on the album, in my opinion. I love it that it sort of croons and kind of cries, unlike the other tracks do. The other ones are sad and boring. This is just kind of heartbreaking in a way.
This one, to me, is if you were to ask me, looking back on it now and knowing the pattern that happened with the band and what happened to them post-band, which both brothers have had successful solo careers, so we can easily say that it doesn't matter about that. This is a Noel Gallagher solo song on an Oasis album.
Mm-hmm.
100%. If I looked back on it now.
Can I tell you what I think about this? And shoot me down if you think this is the dumbest thing you've ever heard, but I think that this is not even an Oasis song. I think that in a different world, this song is built for country radio. I think that this song, the way that it sounds, it has this kind of Dust Bowl vibe to it, you know, that I think that would land hard on just kind of commercial country radio. It doesn't even feel like a Britpop song. It feels like Americana country music to me when I listen to it.
Should we message Darius Rucker?
Yeah, maybe you can take it. Actually, he is. Now that you say that, his voice would be, I think, perfect for it.
I think it would be. Actually, you're not mistaken. You're correct. 100%. This is a very woe is me song. It's a very down on your luck song.
Just needs a couple of references to pickup trucks or some blue jeans.
Is there a dog in the backyard? I don't know. But overall, yes, this is 100% a very self-reflective song. That is the country vibe. I get it. This is the best song on the album. It's not the best recording. It's the best song.
But do you think that there's just so much going on in Gas Panic that really makes that track shine for what this band is?
Yes.
Compared to what you're saying feels just more like Noel Gallagher doing his thing.
This is a Noel Gallagher solo song. This is not a Oasis song.
And so that's what's Liam doing on stage at the time? Just like kind of just...
He may be in the wings drinking a beer, to be honest.
Yeah. Rest in that throat of his.
Yeah.
Okay. Next track. Only got a couple more to go.
And then we have three.
Yeah. Sunday Morning Call.
Mm-hmm.
This is the third single, another Oasis ballad. Not as strong as Don't Look Back in Anger or Don't Go Away. Starts slow and builds to another well-produced track. Catchy and keeps the signature Oasis sound, despite the change in direction, you put in quotations, they were looking for.
Yeah. I guess what I would have said about this one is that, again, so you're looking at, he's going to sing three songs on this album, right? So he's going to sing Where Did It All Go Wrong, Sunday Morning Call, and then...
That was my first comment. He's singing again.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. He sang two of... what was the other one he sang?
Oh, did he have two... Did he have another track before that one?
No, wait a minute. I may be wrong on this one. So, I think he sang two, but... Okay, so it was 10 tracks on the album.
Yes.
Liam doesn't sing on the first one. He sings on the other ones, but then doesn't sing on two of them, so he's only on 7 out of 10.
So he's got 7 out of... Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Mm-hmm. So I may have been wrong on that. Again, like I said, if you're not the strongest vocalist in the group, then you've got to give me a reason why you're singing on a song. If it's because it's a ballad, then I'm okay with it. Does it seem like a lazy ballad? Yes.
In your head, do you feel what you're not supposed to feel? That is a line from this song.
I'm not sure if I feel it.
Right? This is the one where I was just kind of cringing at some of these lyrics.
Yeah.
It's repetitive. It's the same shit over and over again.
So this is supposed to be the Hangover song. This is literally the Hangover song on the Hangover album.
Yeah.
And it's giving me a hangover right now. But what I would say at the end is that, I mean, the production, again, is great. They do some great choral. They do some great orchestration and stuff. And then you get to the point where you go, okay, well, you thought that this album was going to be a little bit more stripped down, but now your orchestration is back up to a point where it seems, this term is used incorrectly at the same time, but overproduced. like, we're adding choral, we're adding orchestra, we're adding something to something.
I think it's this, and I think this is now the fourth track that has a very apparent upfront organ. Just
yeah.
Like this big, just laboring chords yeah. of a piece of organ.
So it just seems to me that it's just like, okay, this is laborious, is the way I would describe it. Laborious songwriting. It's just like, or laborious recording, maybe. It's just like, I got too much on this.
Yeah.
And I don't need this. And this was released as a single too. So now you've got Go Let It Out, which I thought was a great single.
Yeah.
And you've got Who Feels Love and Sunday Morning Call as the other two singles. And I don't think they're good.
How did this get picked as a single? Man, this is just, it's just a downer tune. It's not fun. Like, in the same way that, like, I was describing Where Did All Go Wrong as a tragic song.
Mm-hmm.
There's no tragedy here. It's just sad and stupid.
Yeah.
Like, again, this is one that could have been tossed, in my opinion.
Yep, I think so.
Next to I Can See a Liar. Almost the same as Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is. That's kind of what I was thinking. Almost the same as Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is.
I said that right? Did I say that?
Those are your comments. Yeah. I didn't have yours up when I was putting mine together, but yeah, it feels very much like that song.
Same. Great riff. Great rockin' song. I Can See a Liar Standing by the Fire. So Liar, Liar, Pants on Fire. Bad lyrics.
Yeah. Ooh, wow. No one's, no one's putting that on a tombstone.
No. But, again, I mean, the sound's great. The production is great. The bass line is amazing on this song. And then we've just got some trite lyrics, and that's unfortunate.
Yep. Okay, let's just get to Roll It Over then. Last track on the album.
It's awesome.
Yeah, great epic closing song. Oasis is so good at this. First three albums had the same, and this song is no different. Great production and lyrics, maturation of songwriting, definitely a highlight.
Yes. So for every throwaway track we have one of these.
Yeah.
And Roll It Over starts off very basic, and it's layered. It's layered with an acoustic guitar, electric guitar, the drums, multiple guitar tracks on that one, but not in an overly indulgent way. And then just the lyrics are actually pretty good. I can't say that when he's saying,
roll it over, my son, and leave me here. What is he referring to? What does that even mean?
So what I think is this. So I think that he's talking about the changes that are happening in the band in his life. He's having issues with drug addiction and other kind of things. Roll it over, my son, leave me here. It could be a couple of different things. Just rolling over to a new page, right? But the chorus may not be that profound, but the verses are more profound than many of the other things that were happening on the other tracks in the album.
I know it is one line, and I'm not giving context before and after it, but like, yeah, it sounds like, what is he saying? Like, don't, like, give up on me, son. You go on and do your life. I'm not going to be there.
I think...
Like, what the fuck?
I think it could be...
Or is he saying, I'm abandoning that lifestyle?
And I think that's what it is. I think that's what it is.
Okay. Well, that's...
I think it could be a little bit more profound. And where we find... The stronger tracks are the ones that have the better lyrics.
Yeah.
But that happens with the... like, if you want to say, Where Did It All Go Wrong... or Roll It Over, or Go Let It Out, or some of the other things. Where I think the melody and the lyrics meet together, and where the production is really, really good, even though the production is good on other tracks, these tracks that stand out, they stand out for a reason. Or Gas Panic. I think half of the tracks are like, they're 100% in. And the other tracks, I think they're a filler. Or poorly produced songs.
Yeah.
Because we're going to get into some of the B-sides that I think that should have been included.
We are, in fact, right now. Only thing to bring up, that is a six-minute long song. Did it need to be 6 minutes? I mean, it's your closing track.
Nope.
It's you're going to go have a big rave up at the end of it, so...
It did. It had the rave up. I think we could have cut 2 minutes off of two of the best songs, and they still would have been two of the best songs.
Yeah.
Gas Panic and that one.
All right, let's get to the B-sides then.
Okay.
The first single came out was Go Let It Out.
Yeah.
The two B-sides that appeared on the record were Let's All Make Believe.
The best song recorded for this album.
Yeah.
So I've done three things to you.
Three superlatives you've handed out.
Yes. So I've done the best written song.
Right.
Was that Where Did It All Go Wrong?
Gas Panic is...
the best song they ever put out.
Best song they ever put out, right. Where Did It All Go Wrong is the best song on this album.
And then best recorded song for this album is Let's All Make Believe.
Right.
The reason why I would say that is because it is a complete instrumentation change. There's no guitars in this song.
Yeah.
And it is lyrically really, really good. And it is about, I think, about the departing members of the band. Let's all make believe that we can be friends and we'll still love each other. It is a very heartfelt song, sung by Liam. This is the kind of song that they needed on the album. Yeah. They didn't have it.
That's very spiteful.
Spiteful on my end or spiteful on Noel's end?
Yeah, just as a sentiment.
Yeah. But this should have been on the album. It should have been the second track. Like, yeah. After, like, the intro and then the lead single, just put this one right on.
Yeah.
Just put it right in there. And you take off, I don't know what which track you take off to put it on there, but it needed to be on there. It's not a B-side.
Yeah. The other one is As Long As They've Got Cigarettes in Hell.
Believe it or not, I'd replace Sunday Morning Call with this one because it's a little bit more heartfelt. And if you're going to put a song that's sung by Noel on the album, might as well put one that sounds a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's going to be three singles. So
mm-hmm.
if you're going to spend your hard-earned dollary dues on an Oasis record, would you put it to their B-sides? Do you think this is the one you buy?
I see what you're saying on that point. Like if you're gonna
I'm trying to pin you down. What do you think is the best single of the singles that they put out?
This
or
one.
This record.
This one.
You think this is the one you get?
Yeah.
Okay.
It says the three best songs.
Yeah. So I guess next we got Who Feels Love?
Yeah.
That's the single on it, mm-hmm. which has One Way Road. It's kind of a tongue twister, One Way Road.
It's like an Irish wristwatch.
Irish wristwatch. Irish wristwatch.
I can't do it. One Way Road is, you could take it or leave it. I think it's a good song in terms of, like, the melody's really good. He's got a nice middle eight in there, but it's not something that I would say you could hang your hat on.
Yeah. Okay. You like the falsetto?
Yeah, I did like the falsetto, actually. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
In Summertime, I think it's whenever he says it. He does a good job. And then, again, it's Noel singing it. So, on Goat Let It Out, you've got Let's All Make Believe is a Liam song B-side that should have been on the album. And then you have, at least they have cigarettes, As Long As They Have Cigarettes in Hell, which I think it's a horrible title, horrible chorus in the sense of, like, that's what we're going to do. But I think it's still better than Sunday Morning Call. I put it on the album above Sunday Morning Call.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely, some songs that can be.
What was the other one on?
Helter Skelter.
So, again, they're going to do a cover for a B-side. Noel sings it.
Yeah.
Just let Liam sing it.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all I got on that one. Right. Otherwise, it's pretty good.
Yeah. So Sunday Morning Call, which we agree is kind of a garbage tune.
Not a single. Should have been a B-side. Not on the album.
So you have Carry Us All.
Carry Us All is a really good song.
That's a Noel B-side you wrote here. Still a very good song. Production is slick, but definitely a B-side.
Yeah. It's got a really good middle section. Like, he's got... they're going to carry us all, and then it, like, flows into, like, this nice, like, little minor chord change. It's really, really neat, but I wouldn't have put it on an album.
Yeah. And then this is probably, of all of the songs I've listened to here, this is my second favorite song, full on.
Should have been sung by Noel, sung by Liam, and then replaced I Can See a Liar or Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is on the album.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing is, like, those are also two kind of bigger songs, more anthemic, just big energy songs, and that's mm-hmm. kind of what I want out of this band. And, like, how did they leave this full-on track on the floor? Like, this is probably the hardest song on the whole thing. Yeah. Of all of the things, the tracks that they made during this session, this has to be kind of the most kind of in-your-face aggressive tune.
I think it's disappointing. And if you're going to tell me, if you're going to say, I'm going to take Little James off the record, I'm going to put Let's All Make Believe on the record. So let's just say that right away.
Sure.
That's a stronger record already. And now let's say we're going to take Sunday Morning Call off, and we're going to put As Long As They've Got Cigarettes in Hell. Even if that's a throwaway after your big banger at the end.
Yeah.
Like, that's still a good song.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got two stronger songs. And so now, where can we do Full On in the record? Do we take off Who Feels Love? Do we put Full on there? Do we do...
I don't even think it's about balancing this record, man. I think you just fucking put it in there. Like,
just do it an 11-song record and leave Who Feels Love? That's the thing that I'm saying is that I would say that...
Yeah, I mean, Who Feels Love seems unnecessary. Little James is unnecessary. Sunday Morning Call can go. That's three songs you could just ditch.
Well, I've already got... And I've already put two back on. Yeah. So I've already said that the two B-sides for Go Let It Out should have been on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they blew their load with the single.
I think, maybe that's the thing. Gas Panic is a big high for just charting it. Like, feels like a big crescendo song. Where Did It All Go Wrong is a downer track, but it's also at the same time just, it's a good tune, really heartfelt. I like that one. But then you got Sunday Morning Call after that, which is also just boring. So it's like, you're really low. You're really down in the dumps there. So if Sunday Morning Call is gone, you can just literally plug in any of those three tunes.
Yeah.
And you're feeling a better vibe.
Yeah. So I think overall, I think they had some good tunes. Lyrics aside, I still think they had some good tunes, and I still think it could have pushed up the record a little bit more.
I think we're getting into the next part here. This is what I was going to call like the review, where we just generally talk about the experience of the whole record.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, you want me to? Oh.
I mean, you want me to, whatever.
So overall, I just said, I think that when I first got it, when I first listened to it, and when I first was assessing the way I felt about it, I had some of these same thoughts that I have now, which is like the high points are the high points, the low points are the low points, and what would I have changed? What would I have done different? And right away, as with many of the things that I've done with Oasis Records as a whole, is that they record a lot of songs. They record a lot of songs for their album. They record a lot of B-sides. I have done, personally, for both their first and second album, I actually have what I've called secondary albums with the B-sides, where they actually had another whole album's worth of songs that I thought were good enough to be another album.
I saw that they some of these albums get four or even five singles released, and if all five of those singles have two songs, you've got an entire album of just the B-sides.
Right. And so when I'm coming into this album, and then I see...
By the way, are they sticklers for like a 10-song approach?
I think...
Some bands are like that. Some bands think you've got a complete album with 10 tracks, and why would you need an 11th?
Yeah. I think,
on the A, five on the B, you're done.
I think that's kind of the way he is. Yeah. If you were to ask me. And so it doesn't mean that you have to... I'm going to use this euphemism again, but if you blow your load, you don't have to push everything out, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if they're trying to... This was the mid-90s. It's different, you know, and in America, it was different than in England. In England, you could sell singles. I bought all the import singles. I know what happened with that. You know, I don't know if that meant that if they put three songs on the single that weren't on the album, that meant that they got X amount of more money. Well, like, there like could be...
In the era of the compact disc or the cassette tape, singles are kind of irrelevant because you can fit the same 70 minutes on a CD no matter what.
Right.
There's no point in discounting a CD.
Right, but if let's say that the Ryan Rogers Orchestra puts 10 songs on their album, but then they're going to put three songs on a single that you can't get on the album, so you got to buy that, but that's going to cost you... $5, where the album's going to cost you $10, but that's going to increase your revenue. Is the record company making them do it? I don't know. There's a lot more involved with that.
Yeah.
But I feel...
Well, and singles should exist for the sake of the consumer. They should exist for that person that, like, you know, like the Postal Service had... They were big about singles. They liked releasing singles with B-sides. Mm-hmm. So, like, you could get the Such Great Heights, you know... single and it have interesting B-sides on it.
Well, and that was the thing in Britpop. Like if you look at any of those bands, they all put out singles with all B-sides, okay? Yeah. So they all did it. But I don't know if that was a business model or if that was an artist approach, is what I'm trying to say.
I see.
So did they
go into the studio knowing that they'd have to crank out maybe 6 to 10 extra songs just to have them on hand?
Right. Whereas that could have been their...
In our perspective, they're making some poor decisions about what they would truly consider.
Because that could have been their next album.
Yeah.
So, to me...
Yeah, it's kind of a shame because these songs are not going to get the airplay that they would want as B-sides. Like, if these are truly the better songs that they've recorded and worthy of another session, then it's kind of a shame. They get lost in the shuffle because, like, you did a deep dive on this because you love the band so much.
Well, like you said, you'd said that The Master Plan was an album that was released. That's all B-sides.
Yeah.
And that wasn't even all of them.
Right.
That was the ones that they just handpicked. And by handpicked, I mean Noel Gallagher picked them as the ones he wanted on there.
Yeah.
So you're not even listening to all of them altogether. And that's what I said. Like whenever I did my own mixes, I actually did mixes that were complete 100%. I thought were secondary albums. Yeah. So to go back on this, to put my final stamp on it, to review it as 100%, as an album, I would say, you know, if you were to ask me how's this album rate. I'm going to say it's about a 5 or a 6. There's some really good tracks and some really bad tracks. If you were to put some songs on there that I thought were relegated to B-sides that should be on there, maybe we can move that up to a 6.5 or a 7.
Yeah.
And then where do we go from there?
Yeah.
And that's where I'm at with this album. If you were to ask me to rate it as a whole, it's underwhelming.
Yeah, that's kind of
as it was set through. Even though it was a high seller.
Yeah, I tend to agree there with the same thought, and that this album just sort of falls in the middle. It doesn't manage to be impressively bad or good. It just simply is. It's just sort of there doing its thing. It has no big singles. There is not a song. Again, where did it all go wrong? I could imagine someone at midnight just drunkenly singing this at karaoke. That song, sure. I don't see another song in here that's going to have people really singing along or grooving to or just like really getting into that you hear with their other albums. There's just none of that anthemic stuff going on. I think their weak songwriting is pretty apparent because, again, you don't have those huge moments. Yeah. Honestly, yeah, I'm kind of right there with you. I think this is kind of right in the middle of the road of a band that knows how to craft a single, just not really doing it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you point out where they know how to craft a single but they don't, it's part of it is a production thing. Part of it is saying the big moments are there. You use the big moments on your previous albums and you're trying to steer away from that. And by doing so, you're handicapping yourself.
So yeah, Yola Tango released an album in the same month that this came out. And that was one of the best critically reviewed albums I could find in that month. And I don't know about you, what your opinion, if you even listen to them. I think they're boring as fuck. But that's what people liked about them. That's what the critics really liked, said they liked about it, was that kind of earthy production that you kind of feel like you're in the room with them playing their instruments mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And, you know, no one ever looked at Yola Tango to make an anthemic song or something you could play in an arena, sure. But at the same time, like, that's the 100% thing this album should get credit for. Is that it does sound really good. You know, the guitar tones are fantastic.
Sonically, the production is fantastic. One of the things that I would say about this album, as a final note on this discussion, is that the biggest quote-unquote band in the UK prior to this album was Travis. And Travis had released an album called The Man Who, and that was released in 1999, I believe. And it was produced by Nigel Godrich of Radiohead fame, who had done The Bends and OK Computer, another British band that I didn't mention, so you could, you know, chalk that up. But one of the things that album established, and one of the things that is different than this album, is that there was a lot of focus on spatial production, an instrument here, an instrument there, the way that the sound would enter into your ear, and then the overall kind of like, we're going to minimalize production to get those spaces there.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things that had kind of happened. I mean, if you listen to the Radiohead albums and you listen to the Travis album, they're two completely different artists with completely different styles. Oasis and Travis are very much more similar than Oasis and Radiohead, or Travis and Radiohead. But listen to The Man Who, and then listen to Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, and you'll realize that those are two different soundscapes and different ways that things were going.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you would go ahead and say, that's my assessment of the album. Music was going in a different direction, and they didn't follow.
All right. I hate to close on this note, because this is kind of a downer thing, but the commercial reception of this has to be construed as a massive failure of a record. Listen to these numbers. This is really sad. The record barely sold worldwide 3 million copies. I don't know what you're thinking, like, 3 million, that's a lot of copies. It really isn't, when you consider that the year 2000 would see four different albums in America sell over 15 million copies.
Which ones?
Ooh, I don't know if I can name them all off the top of my head, but NSYNC released No Strings Attached,
okay,
which I'll step up to bat. That's a fucking amazing record. Eminem released Marshall Mathers LP, huge hit. And Linkin Park released Hybrid Theory.
Okay.
And the fourth one I'm actually not sure about. I want to say it's a Britney Spears record, but there's a fourth one out there. I mean, other albums like Disturbs the Sickness sold 5 million copies. Papa Roach Infest sold 8 million copies. And they can't get 3 million copies, considering Be Here Now sold 8 million copies. What's the Story Morning Glory sold 22 million copies worldwide. Even The Master Plan outsold this record.
The Master Plan's got better songs. And I will tell you this. I think that overall, you're going to see a change in the music landscape, because the bands that you mentioned that sold a lot of copies, Pop Stars, New Rock, NU Rock.
Yeah, New Rock.
So you're looking at a band.
Oh, but by the way, like, honestly, so many records sold millions of copies. This is also the peak of commercial music. This is sort of like when physical media reigned supreme.
Yeah. I don't know if they were in their right lane anymore.
Yeah.
Either.
They said that it was also, I don't have the numbers here in front of me, but it was the highest selling first week of an album in England, or in the UK.
Oh, no, it was, like I said at the outset, it definitely was highly anticipated.
But then also had one of the biggest fall-offs. I think it dropped 70%.
Underwhelming.
Week. Yeah. I think that the word got out that this was just not a great record, and sales just weren't there for it.
Nope. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. So I guess we'll leave it there, man. Kind of a downer note to close this on. But this has been a fantastic discussion.
Right. What I would say is this, is that, you know, if you go back through, listen to a couple of the stronger tracks, maybe, you know, through your own, if you wanted to be a creative producer and say, you know, why don't I flush in a couple ones, take out a couple other ones, you know, mix and match something. Do we have a more promising record? Do we have
totally.
A situation where we could have been, and this is something that I would say as a final thing. I mean, these are obviously, when Noel Gallagher got in the band, he was the driving creative force. He was the one who was saying, this is the way things are going to go. Do we have somebody as an executive producer, or as a someone who could say, you know, let's go back in and go, you know what? I'd like this song off the album. I like this one on the album. Can we place these differently? What would have the reception been? What could it have been different? Could it have been better? Could it have been worse? I would say if you're going to throw all of the kettles, all the, you know, the coals in the fire and say, let's figure out which things are going to be the best things for this product, which songs are going to be the best songs for the album, you may find a different reaction at the end of the day, which is sad to say.
And maybe that's just me. I would think that they would want to have a record that people are driving fast down the highway listening to, windows down, blaring it, Yeah. You know, that's what Oasis I think should sound like.
Yeah.
And you know, they just kind of they fail to capture that.
Yeah, I think I agree. It doesn't have the energy as the other records, even before or after. I think the other records after have a little bit more energy than this one too.
Okay, so we got 2 years to wait for the next one, huh?
Yeah. So I'll see you in 2 years.
Yeah. Hey, if we keep doing this chronologically. Oh man, we got Yin Yang Twins. Thug Walkin' just came out.
So, oh yeah.
Yeah, that was their debut album. It's fucking amazing.
Oh, I can't wait for it.
Yeah. All right, we'll call it there, man. Thank you for coming on, and I hope this isn't the last one we record. I hope we can get some more of these in the
book. Oh, no, I'd love to. You know, there's plenty of things that are coming up on the horizon. I mean, the rest of 2000, 2001, 2002. I'm there with you, buddy.
All right, sounds good.
All right, take it easy.
Yeah, take it easy.
You ain't exactly sure.